President David O. McKay.
President Taylor, Dr. Groh, deans, members of the faculty, and students of the Brigham Young University. It's a great responsibility to meet you this morning, as well as a great joy. I'm going to make a confession to you. In a speech to a group of journalists, a well-known cartoonist, David Lowe, stated that every time he had to make a speech, he felt as if he had a block of ice 9 inches by 9 inches right in the pit of his stomach. After the speech, he was approached by a member of the audience, Mr. Lloyd George, who said, Mr. Lowe, how large did you say that block of ice is? Lowe answered, 9 inches by 9 inches. What an amazing coincidence, commented Lloyd George. It's exactly the same as size as mine. I believe my block of ice, since President Wilkinson invited me here, is about 12 by 12. Not so much in fear of this moment, anticipating it, but the difficulty in choosing what might be appropriate, and the greater difficulty in presenting the subject in a manner that will be pleasing and impressive. Many subjects suggest themselves, but I finally decided to speak upon marriage. Young men think about it, young girls give an occasional thought. I was encouraged in my thought yesterday when I had conversation with one of the noblest leaders of youth in the United States, Dr. Shuck, head of the Boy Scout movement in the United States. During the conversation, he referred to the family department of the Brigham Young University and paid you high tribute. And I was impressed with the responsibility of the student body, of the members of this great institution in regard to marriage. I had written down the text we find in the Doctrine and Covenants, that whoso forbiddeth to marry is not ordained of God. For marriage is ordained of God unto man. Wherefore, it is lawful that he should have one wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. And all this that the earth might answer the end of its creation, and that it might be filled with the measure of man, according to his creation before the world was. Recently, Sister McKay read me a letter written by a young girl inner teens. Without giving any names, I'm going to quote from that letter as illustrative of one of the five topics that I'm going to name this morning as contributing to a happy marriage. The first is maintaining a good reputation. And that takes us back to the teenage. A happy marriage begins before you go to the altar. It begins while you're accepting invitations to go to the party. It begins when the manner in which you say good night to your companion. This girl writes, being a teenager is quite confusing to me because there are so many temptations and problems which seem to come all at once. One of these problems, which has bothered me a great deal, concerns dating. I have heard so many different ideas and explanations on this subject, I am quite confused. The entire tenor of the letter shows the sincerity of this sweet girl. But I have gone out with boys for a good year and a half, and I have learned many things. I felt that I would like to save my affection until I meet the man that I am to marry. However, several of my friends seriously disagree with me and feel that I am being an extremist. They've made me very unhappy because of many things they have said. And I've begun to wonder if some of my ideas might be wrong. Most all of us agree that it is wrong to sit and kiss and spoon for long periods of time. I'm completely against that. But they tell me that after a boy has taken me out several times and shown me a good time, I should show my appreciation by a goodnight kiss. I've never felt this to be true. And several boys that I have dated have been quite offended. And feeling that I didn't like them, they have quit asking me out. When I do finally meet the man I should marry, I shall want to give him all my love and affection. And I believe that the kiss will mean more if it hasn't been thrown to all the other boys too. She was in doubt as to what she should do. And she wrote to one who she thought could help her. I should like to present to all the young people of the church through you a guide, a safe guide in regard to your actions, young ladies, towards young men. And to you young men, a guide for your actions towards young women. And I'm going to present to you a fact stated by one of our leading judges regarding Chinese ideals. A New York City judge, not long ago, wrote to the New York Times saying that in the 17 years he had been on the bench, not one Chinese American teenager had been brought before him on a juvenile delinquency charge. The judge queried his colleagues, And they agreed that not one of the city's estimated 10,000 Chinese-American teenagers, to their knowledge, had ever been hailed into court on a depredation, narcotics, speeding, burglary, vandalism, stick-up, purse-snatching, or mugging accusation. A check with San Francisco, where there is a large colony of Chinese Americans, tells the same story. The same holds true of Chicago. P.H. Chang, Chinese Consul General in New York City, was asked to comment. He said, "I have heard this story many times from many judges. I will tell you why I think this is so. Filial piety is a cardinal virtue my people have brought over from the China that was once free. A Chinese child, no matter where he lives, is brought up to recognize that he cannot shame his parents. Before a Chinese child makes a move, he stops to think what the reaction of his parents will be. Will they be proud or will they be ashamed? Above all things, the Chinese teenager is anxious to please his parents. Most Chinese Americans, no matter how wealthy or poor, maintain a strict family-style home. Mealtimes are ceremonious affairs which must be attended by every member of the family. Schooling, the reverence for religion, and decorum plus reverence for the elders are the prime movers in developing the child from infancy. The amazing record of the Chinese American youngsters shows that it is in the home that the cure for juvenile delinquency will be found, and in no other place." That young girl could be safely guided, as every young girl, if she stops to say, "What will my actions tonight do to my mother, to my father, to the standards of purity in our home?" That's a safe guide for our actions in life regarding our own eternal parents. Over half a century ago, I read a book, which you've probably read, entitled "What Would Jesus Do?" It was printed in London at that time. Throughout life, it's been a safe guide. When problems came, to ask, "Could I face my Heavenly Father on this question and justify my action before Him?" It's always a safe guide during courtship. Here's the story of a girl who didn't believe that. She thought that the best way would be to win the favor of young men by indulging, granting their wishes. The author of this has called her Sally. It's under the heading, "It's Your Date," and written by Morgan Jones, printed in one of our leading magazines recently. You've probably read it. Sally is a pretty girl, and she dresses well. She rarely lacks for a date in the middle of the week. She's never free on weekends. But her dates come and go with the regularity of the ocean tides. And for the most part, they are just as impersonal. Fellows date Sally for the single reason that she is well known as an easy mark. To be seen with her several times bolsters a man's reputation as a Casanova who knows his way around. But few fellows date her any longer than it takes to find congenial replacements all their own. The new girl may not be so attractive or stylish or all the things that Sally ironically owns up to. But her date will feel that she is his alone, not inclined to neck with Tom tomorrow as she did with Frank the day before. Most fellows enjoy holding hands or stealing a kiss or two. But Sally is caught in such a social trap, it seems almost impossible for her not to neck. If she doesn't care to, her date, who has had detailed information about her from other fellows in their crowd, is profoundly insulted. Sally finds herself in this social blind alley because she once felt so little confidence in herself as a person that she resorted to necking to ensure her popularity. And now she finds that her success is built on sand. She would be much better off if she revised her thinking completely and began to function as someone who has a right to be accepted on her own terms rather than as a girl who's always good for a necking session, as a boy said to her, like his companions. Dates may slack off for a while, girls. But when they come back, they're more likely to last. A good reputation may sound stuffy, but it is something to cherish. Men are apt to talk about girls among themselves. A lady of taste doesn't want her name bandied around in a men's bull session. You'll feel happier and have more freedom if your parents have confidence in your behavior. The decision is up to you. The average guy never takes advantage of a girl he really likes. The lines of that Rotarian come to me on this. I'll just paraphrase them somewhat. In that poem or philosophic treatise, he's more of a philosopher than a poet, on friendship, the obligation of friendship. In the second stanza, he calls our attention to home, as I'm doing now. And he says to the young, you ought to be true for the sake of the folks who think you are true. You never should stoop to a deed that your folks think you would not do. If you're false to yourself, be the blemish but small. You've injured your folks. You've been false to them all. And then he concludes in a very remarkable stanza on friendship. For friendship, my boy, is founded on truth. It believes in the best of the ones that it loves, whether old man or youth. And the stern rule it lays down for me and for you is to be what our friends, and I'm going to say what our folks think we are, through and through. And so, If you would have a happy marriage, keep your reputation unsullied. I remember as a boy in my teens, out on a summer afternoon walk with sweet companions. We walked up the middle lane. On each side of the road were the wild roses. We didn't stop to pluck any because they were covered with the dust of travelers. We soon reached the hillside. There too were roses, free from the dust of the traveler, each one kissed only by the sunshine and morning dew. We plucked that rose and gave to the girl companion who seemed so worthy of it. This principle seems to me to strike right at the base of happiness in the marriage relation. This standard of purity taught and practiced among the Latter-day Saints. It's a common saying throughout the world that young men may sow their wild oats, but young women should be chaperoned and guarded. And be it said to their credit that, generally speaking, the young women are protected. The young men, however, are given too free license, if statistics tell the truth. In the Church of Christ, there's but one standard of morality. No young man has any more right to sow his wild oats in youth than has a young girl. And she is taught that second only to the crime of taking human life is that of losing her virtue. And that should be the ideal among young men. I know from experience that the world will not believe us when we tell them that that ideal is followed. But we know in our hearts that it's true. That young man who comes to his bishop to ask for a recommend to take a pure girl to the altar is expected to give just the same purity that he expects to receive. No one can transgress the laws of chastity and find peace. That's the message to our boys and girls in this school and throughout the church. No matter what the opportunity, no matter what the temptation, let the young man know that to find happiness, he must hold sacred his true manhood. Let him know that he's going to live and live completely by refusing to yield to the temptation. Then he's happy. There's peace instead of turbulency in his soul. There's a law in the statute books passed a few years ago that makes it necessary for every young man to be tested. Science has protected him and the girls, but that law stands because there's an obligation to society in marriage as well as to the individual. You remember that remarkable poem written by Ella Wheeler Wilcox on this point, where the young man threw aside thoughts of chivalry, treated girls as things, and had his fling. And Ella Wheeler Wilcox states the result. The last stanza of which, if I recall, is this. They, I said I'd have my fling. And they knew the paths I would go. Yet no one told me a thing of what I needed to know. Folks talk too much of a soul from heavenly joys debarred. but are not enough of the babes unborn by the sins of their fathers scarred. Who steals my purse steals trash. 'Twas something nothing. 'Twas mine, 'tis his, and hath been slave to thousands. But he who robs me of my good name robs me of that which he hath not, which doth not enrich him, but leaves me poor indeed. Girls, keep your reputation unsullied. The second ideal our name is contributive to the happiness of marriage begins when you kneel at the altar. Each giving to the other what each demands. And each covenanting to be true to the other. I received a letter not long ago from a young girl who became engaged. And that young, unchivalrous man referred to the covenant of marriage as a piece of paper, that the engagement was all that's necessary. Well, society demands something else. It has for ages. And that covenant is more than just a sheet of paper. It's the right of union between two. And it's an obligation to society to perpetuate the race. A man who gives his word, if he's honorable, is bound more than when he signs a contract, because his word is his bond. And so is that contract at marriage, and particularly when the couple kneels in the house of the Lord, signifying that each is worthy of the other. The young girl knows that he to whom she gives herself is just as worthy of fatherhood as she of motherhood. And she has that right to think so. There's the beginning of a happy marriage. Each is free from any memory of the boy who had his fling. It's a glorious, glorious feeling to know that each is for the other and only. Marriage offers an opportunity to share in the love and care of children. And that's the purpose of marriage. It's for husbands and wives, yes, but it's also for children. Without children, or without believing that children are important, marriage is incomplete and unfulfilled. Children take time, trouble, and more patience than we usually have. They interfere with freedom, good times, and luxury. But children are the real purpose and reason behind marriage. If we do not put the proper value on parenthood, we are not emotionally or socially ready for marriage. Marriage is a relationship that cannot survive selfishness, impatience, domineering, inequality, and lack of respect. Marriage is a relationship that thrives on acceptance, equality, sharing, giving, helping, doing one's part, learning together, and enjoying humor. And that bond, when broken, proves the violator one who cannot be trusted. To be trusted is a greater compliment than to be loved. Do not think that that bond, that covenant you make, is not a contributing factor to your happiness in marriage. And so we have, as a beginning, a good reputation. We have honor at the marriage altar. The responsibility of proving that we hold our word, our promise, above a written contract. The third I name is control in the home. It's said that during courtship we should keep our eyes wide open, but after marriage keep them half shut. What I mean may be illustrated by the remark of a young married woman who said to her husband, "I know my cooking isn't good. I hate it as much as you do. But do you find me sitting around griping about it?" This griping after marriage is what makes it unpleasant. Learn self-control. Control of the tongue. Was it Carlton, Will Carlton, who said, "Boys flying kites haul in their white-winged birds." You can't do that when you're flying words. Thoughts unexpressed may sometimes fall back dead, but God Himself can't kill them when they're said. I had thought first of speaking on the need of spirituality, rising from the animal plane up into the realm of spirit. That's where we are. Scientists agree with us. Evolutionists agree with us. Well, in the home is the place to develop that spirituality. The very first quality of which is control of speech, of appetite, of passion. And in the home is the best place to learn it. Don't say the word. Just walk outdoors. I once heard of a couple who never had a quarrel because they decided that whenever one lost his temper that he used to go out and take a walk. They both took a good many walks, so they had no trial, no quarrels. A fourth contributing factor, my name is courtesy. During courtship, each is pleased to anticipate the wishes of the other. You take joy in granting those wishes within the bounds of propriety. Too many couples look upon the covenant, the marriage altar, as the end of courtship. It should be the beginning of an eternal courtship. And that means consideration in the home. Same consideration for the wife that was given to the sweetheart in courtship. The same consideration to the husband, even though he sits behind the paper in the morning and doesn't say a word. Life becomes a humdrum. But that humdrum is broken if we just remember that if you please, that thank you, that pardon me, are just as appropriate and are much appreciated by a wife as our sweetheart appreciated. And in the home blessed with children, the very purpose of a home, children seeing father courteous to mother and mother to father, partake themselves of that element, that attribute, just as they breathe the air of the home. And they become courteous also, and thus become refined and cultured children. For the essence of true culture is consideration for somebody else, for others. Do not forget that after marriage, when trials begin and debts begin to pile up and taxes have to be paid, babies have to be toddled at night and fed at night, a lot of little troubles, that courtesy is a contributive factor to harmony and peace in the home. How sweet and gracious, says James T. Field, how sweet and gracious, even in common speech, is that fine sense which men call courtesy. Wholesome summer's air, and genial is the light. Welcome in every clime is breath of flowers. It transmutes aliens into trusting friends and gives us a passport round the globe. Nothing is more becoming in a great man than courtesy and forbearance. Be punctual with your wife and with your children. If duties detain you, do not hesitate to apologize and explain. They are important factors. They deserve the best you have. The fifth and concluding contributing factor to a happy marriage is companionship. Do you remember reading in the introduction to The Woman Who Understands this paragraph? Is this the little woman that made this great war? Was Lincoln's greeting to Harriet Beecher Stowe. Often, too, she shapes the career of husband or brother or son. A man succeeds and reaps the honors of public applause when in truth a quiet little woman has made it all possible. Has by her tact and encouragement held him to his best. Has had faith in him when his own faith has languished. Has cheered him with the unfailing assurance, you can, you must, you will. Somewhere she waits to make you win. Your soul in her firm white hands. Somewhere the gods have made for you, the woman who understands, helping and loving and guiding, urging when that were best, keeping her fears in hiding deep in her quiet breast. This is the woman who kept him true to his standards high, watching and guarding, whispering still, when you can, you must, you will. The more you keep in company with that woman, the happier you are. Business takes you away from home. She's there alone. Do not let companionship with some other woman divide your affection. And that's true with the woman as well as the man. At one time I thought it was not, that man was wholly to blame for the unrest, the disagreements and the separations that are occurring too frequently. But woman has her responsibility too. Companionship is the means of perpetuating that love which brought you together first. That old saying that absence makes the heart grow fonder isn't true, unless you add that fonder for the other fellow. Companionship. In conclusion, for the proper solution of the great problem of marriage, we may turn with safety to Jesus as our guide. He declared that the marriage relation is of divine origin, and that marriage is ordained of God, that only under the most exceptional conditions should it be set aside. In the teaching of the Church of Christ, the family assumes supreme importance in the development of the individual and of society. Happy and thrice happy are they who enjoy an uninterrupted union, and whose love, unbroken by any complaints, shall not dissolve until the last day. It shall not dissolve when sealed by the authority throughout all eternity. The marriage ceremony, when thus sealed, as do family relationships through time, produce happiness and joy, unsurpassed by any other experience in the world. What therefore God has joined together, let no man put asunder. God bless the students of Brigham Young University. Prosper the Family Relationship Department. That the thousands of students who are coming from other states, under the trust of parents, may find here ideals which will contribute to their happiness, not only during school years, but through time and all eternity. I pray in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.